Jenny Finch, author, creator of The Drowners and Death of the Elver Man, and general Renaissance woman, your host for the Book of the Month.
Southside Broadcasting's latest Book of the Month is Rivers of London by Ben Aronovich. The first in a series of novels, Rivers of London is an original and highly compelling book. Set in the capital of the present day, it is on one hand a crime novel. However, it is much more than that, containing elements of humour, fantasy and horror in fairly equal amounts. The book is narrated by Peter Grant, a newly qualified probationary constable who escapes a posting to the Case Progression Unit, unofficial motto, "We do paperwork so real coppers don't have to," when he unwittingly interviews a witness to murder who turns out to be a ghost. Grant is offered an apprenticeship to DCI Nightingale, the last wizard in England and sole member of the archaic magical police section based at the Folly. As well as policing the hidden supernatural elements of the city, PC Grant embarks on a long and intensive training, one involving spells, identification of magical elements, alchemy, and much to his disgust, a lot of Latin.
The north end of the London borough of Camden is dominated by two hills, Hampstead on the west, Highgate on the east, with the Heath, one of the largest parks in London, slung between them like a green saddle. From these heights the land slopes down towards the River Thames and the floodplains that lurk below the built-up centre of London. Dartmouth Park, where William Skirmish had lived, was on the lower slopes of Highgate Hill and within easy walking distance of the Heath. He'd had the ground floor flat of a converted Victorian terrace, the corner house of a tree-lined street that had been traffic-calmed to within an inch of its life. Further downhill was Kentish Town, Leighton Road, and the estate where I grew up. Some of my schoolmates had lived around the corner from Skirmish's flat, so I knew the area well. I spotted a face in a first-floor window as we showed our cards to the uniform guarding the door. As in many converted terraces, a once elegant hallway had been walled off with plasterboard, making it cramped and lightless. Two additional front doors had been jammed side by side into the space at the end. The door on the right was half open, but symbolically blocked with police tape. The other presumably belonged to the flat with the twitching curtains upstairs. Skirmish's flat was neat, and furnished in the patchwork of styles that ordinary people, the ones not driven by aspirational demons, choose for their homes. Fewer bookcases than I would have expected from a media type. Many photographs, but the ones of children were all black and white, or the faded colour of old instamatic film.
The central story is the hunt for a powerful and malevolent spirit haunting the centre of London and spreading riot and mayhem wherever he materialises. Using the bodies of others, this revenant commits a series of violent and bloody acts before instigating a major riot at the Royal Opera House. Those unfortunate enough to be bewitched by him die horribly as their brains shrivel up and their faces split apart and peel off. As the spirit gains experience and power, he widens his influence, launching an attack on the Folly itself. Despite the elements of fantasy and horror, this story is actually a very good police procedural, following the genre quite closely.
It began when I started a practice session without taking my phone out of my jacket pocket. I even noticed a little flare in intensity when I formed the wear light. But I'd only been reliably casting for 2 days, so it didn't register as significant. It was only later, when I tried to call Leslie and found my phone was busted, that I opened up the case and saw the same trickle of sand I noticed at the Vampire House. I took it down to the lab and prized out the microprocessor. As it came loose, the same fine sand streamed out of its plastic casing. The gold pins were intact, as were the contacts, but the silicon bit of the chip had disintegrated. The cupboards in the lab were full of the scent of sandalwood and the most amazing range of antique equipment, including the Charles Perry microscope, all put away with such precision and tidiness that I knew no student had been involved. Under the microscope, I found the powder to be mostly silicon with a few impurities which I suspected was germanium or gallium arsenide. The chip that handled RF conversion was superficially intact, but had suffered microscopic pitting across its entire surface. The patterns reminded me of Mr. Cooper Town's brain. This was my phone on magic, I thought. Obviously, I couldn't do magic and carry a mobile phone, or stand near a computer, or an iPod, or most of the useful technology invented since I was born. No wonder Nightingale drove a 1967 Jag. The question was, how close did the magic have to be? I was formulating some experiments to find out when Nightingale distracted me with my next form. We sat down on opposite sides of the lab bench, and Nightingale placed an object between us. It was a small apple. "Impello," he said, and the apple rose into the air. It hung there, rotating slowly, while I checked for wires, rods, and anything else I could think of. I poked it with my finger, but it felt like it was embedded in something solid. "Seen enough?" I nodded, and Nightingale brought out a basket of apples. A wicker basket with a handle and a check napkin, no less. He placed a second apple in front of me, and I didn't need him to explain the next step. He levitated the apple. I listened for the forma, concentrated on my own apple, and said, "Impello." I wasn't really that surprised when nothing happened. "It does get easier," said Nightingale. "It's just that it gets easier slowly." I looked at the basket. "Why do we have so many apples?" "They have a tendency to explode," said Nightingale. The next morning I went out and brought three sets of eye protectors and a heavy-duty lab apron. Nightingale hadn't been kidding about the exploding fruit, and I'd spent the afternoon smelling of apple juice and the evening picking pips out of my clothing. I asked Nightingale why we didn't train with something more durable like ball bearings, but he said that magic required the mastery of fine control right from the start. "Young men are always tempted to use brute force," Nightingale had said. "It's like learning to shoot a rifle. Because it's inherently dangerous, you teach safety, accuracy, and speed in that order." We went through a lot of apples in that first session. I was getting them in the air, but sooner or later, splat. There was a brief phase when it was fun, and then it got boring. After a week of practice, I could levitate an apple without it exploding 9 times out of 10. I wasn't a happy little wizard, though. What worried me was where the power was coming from. I never was very good at electricity, so I don't know how much power it took to make a wear light. But levitating one small apple against the Earth's gravity, that was essentially the standard definition of 1 newton of force, and it should be using 1 theoretical joule of energy every second. The laws of thermodynamics are pretty strict about this sort of thing, and they say that you never get something for nothing, which meant that the joule was coming from somewhere. But from where?
Where Rivers of London departs from the norm is through the subplot of the title. A feud breaks out between the two families of the London Rivers, those above Teddington Lock, who follow Father Thames, and those below, who look to Mama Thames. Each member of the two families is the spirit of one of the many lost and underground rivers, Tyburn, Fleet, Lee and Oxley, amongst others, and a fierce rivalry between the North and South clans threatens the age-old agreement and truce. The river spirits weave through the main plot, aiding or foiling Constable Grant's efforts to catch the Revenant, but always emerging as immensely powerful magical beings to be treated with respect, as he discovers on his visits to their respective courts. Rivers of London wraps up the crime elements of the story very neatly, whilst leaving enough threads from the other aspects to link to later books. It is a difficult balancing act, weaving the genres together, but Aronovitch is successful in balancing the different elements in the story and producing a unified and most enjoyable book. In the midst of some gruesome detail, his turn of phrase lifts the reader's mood without breaking the spell of his story. The test of a good book is it leaves you wanting to know more, and Rivers of London hits this mark most successfully. And it has a wonderful cover.
Lincoln Inspired is more than just an arts festival, more than a literary festival, more than a whole set of lifestyle opportunities, and more than what the world has needed for millennia.
To see just how much more Lincoln Inspired can make you, go to lincolninspired.co.uk and explore the inspiration.
Parkville is a purpose-built residential care centre situated at the heart of Middlesbrough and providing personalised care in a modern and homely environment. Parkville aims to help older people to continue to live independent and active lives within the wider community whilst benefiting from the care and support of an experienced and dedicated team of nursing and care staff. At Parkville, we provide facilities to accommodate residential elderly and residential EMI service users. To find out more, please telephone 01642 223334. That's 01642 223334. Parkville Care Centre. Care to call us home.
Strokes affect 130,000 people in England and Wales each year. Here's a recipe that can dramatically decrease your chances of strokes.
Excellent. I better get a pen.
167 grams of calcium.
Hang on. Slow down.
And one tablespoon. Remember, any more than one tablespoon could kill you. Any less than one tablespoon could kill you.
Right, what was
the recipe? That's the recipe.
If you
would like a more simple solution, you can always call Farmer Nord on 01670 519989.
All right.
Or visit the website farmernord.co.uk.
Let me see if I can jot that down. What was the number again?
01670 519989. Or visit the website farmernord.co.uk.
And how do you spell Farmer Nord, I wonder?
PHARMANORD.co.uk.
It's almost as if I'm having a conversation with the radio.
Don't be silly, that's impossible.
Farmer Nord, winning the war of nutrition.
You're listening to a Southside Broadcasting podcast. Southside Broadcasting is a media company which aims to provide a wide range of features from the rural, health and lifestyle worlds. You can regularly listen to entertaining podcasts with interviews and correspondence from Los Angeles, Nashville, New York and London. You can take part in our Book of the Month features, grab some great nutritional advice, enjoy broadcasts from the Great Yorkshire Show, the Lincolnshire Show, and enjoy local football reviews with our regular feature, Fly Me to the Moon. You can even hear a BAFTA award-winning director drive a train full of teddy bears. You can listen to these and many more podcasts at southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com. For further information on how you can join over 35,000 people who regularly download our podcasts, call us on 01642 854 742 or email info@southsidebroadcasting.com now.
With a high-spec accommodation, all with ensuite facilities and high-quality care for residents provided 24/7 by qualified nurses and carers, Roseville Care Centre provides the perfect home for its residents' emotional, spiritual, social, physical and intellectual needs.
A purpose-built residential care facility in the heart of Ingleby Barwick, Roseville is a care centre which provides facilities to accommodate residential nursing and dementia service users, offering both short and long stay accommodation, as well as respite and daycare.
To find out more, please telephone 01642 30 81 88 or email us at roseville@prestigegroup.uk.com.
Roseville Care Centre. Care.
Jenny Finch, author, creator of The Drowners and Death of the Elver Man, and general Renaissance woman, your host for the Book of the Month.
quite right too. Okay, Jenny, another classic there in terms of Rivers of London. I would describe it probably as Inspector Morse meets Harry Potter.
Yes, but a bit more gory in both sides.
Yeah, a bit more gory, a little bit more language. I was interested in terms of how similar it was to Neil Gaiman's tale on Neverwhere a few years ago.
Yes,
where he personalises an awful lot of the characters of London and sees them as real notions and very much takes the essence of the organic nature of London and how as a city it kind of manifests itself and comes alive. And as we mentioned, the rivers of London very much at the fore of that.
Yes, there are distinct similarities. And actually, Neverwhere is one of my absolute favourite books. I think that organic nature of London is very important, and I think he's captured it very well.
I was particularly impressed with his coverage of an area that I know very well in London, which is Covent Garden, and even the supermarkets that were listed within there, and the Royal Opera House, and the chase sequences that were put within that whole thing. And what Aranovich certainly seems to have managed to capture is the essence of good research, so that you can actually read it. And I'm quite happily say that you could actually sort of walk through the actual sites, and they all sort of slot into place, really.
Well, he actually lives there. So he's writing about his home turf, and there's an obvious love of the place that's there, which comes over.
Peter Grant as a character, portrayed as a sort of Barack Obama lookalike in certain ways, and I'm interested in terms of the line within that. Obviously, he's led quite solidly by his hormones, because they tend to emerge at various times, and his views, and obviously his initial sort of partner Leslie, who has an unfortunate sort of experience, but I think she lives at the end. I mean, I think we're left to understand that the bandages and the water have kind of kept her sort of intact after a fashion.
They have, and in fact she does feature in the next and the one after that.
Yeah, and of course it's an ongoing scene, Moon Over Soho, Whispers Underground, and indeed Broken Homes, which comes through from the perspective. The Punch and Judy show, which is very much at the heart of the whole message, is something which, yes, if you look back at Punch and Judy, you think, well, that's wife beating, that's baby bashing, that's dreadful, that's just not politically correct. And I think what Aranovich has actually done quite nicely here is he's taken the kind of traditional notions of that and actually seen them as the villains, as the people who are kind of working through that, cued in nicely with a nice little twist. I mean, no spoilers, obviously, but in terms of who the actual villain tends to be, I don't think we actually quite see that notion. I mean, again, Grant's story starts when he tries to take a witness statement from a man who was already dead, and takes him down a twisting, turning, centuries-old mystery that reckons to set modern London on fire. Interesting stuff there.
Yes.
And the time travel, which I possibly might have thought was maybe unnecessary. It was just one of those areas where I thought the big chunk of time where suddenly Aranovich really picks up the pace, moves it along, etc., and then there's the sort of vampire connection and the hallucination, the illusory thing. I thought that might have been, I don't know, I think it could have run without that. I was thinking Sarah Pinborough, who's an excellent author as well, I think sometimes manages to realise that you need to just pull back slightly on that. I don't know, just a thought.
It does seem... It's a very well-written piece. It's a very interesting piece, the time travel piece, but it doesn't seem to add an enormous amount to the actual book itself.
This is my point.
It's almost as if that belongs in another book.
Yeah. I'm thinking for that perspective. The Daily Telegraph, of course, told in a narrative voice that seasons laconic humour with a dash of cynicism. The novel is fascinated with the geography and history of London. It is a rich formula with a bittersweet ending. Also joining us for the Book of the Month, as ever, the fabulous Robert Nichols. Robert, tragically, due to events beyond our control,
yes,
we were not able to get hold of a copy of the book in time from the whole thing. But from what we've actually said, and I know, obviously, as somebody who actually did archaeology and worked through this sort of anthropology, you still are involved with time digs and things, aren't you, in archaeological digs?
Still am, yes. From time to time, yes.
This sort of take on history is something which, I mean, London seems to attract it in so many ways, doesn't it?
And because of the, I guess, the many layers of London, and if you think about the redevelopment of the centre of London, in some cases it's the old city has come back, because around St Paul's they've reclaimed the old street pattern, so it's still always there, impressing that the past is impressing on the present and the future.
Yeah, we can't really sort of differentiate between them. But from what you've actually heard, is it the kind of novel which you think, oh, yes, I'll go with that? I mean, on the one hand, you could say, well, it's obviously the start of a series, but it isn't a trilogy, so if people are worried about, oh, I don't know where we're going to, from that sort of point of view, I know we've had issues before in terms of, it's just stopped, we'll buy the next one.
Yeah. It sounds really interesting, Alex, definitely. And I've enjoyed books that I've read set in present-day London in the past, and this does sound really interesting. I'm not much into vampire read.
Well, that was something which, again, I was thinking, it comes into that element of urban fantasy, which is a very popular genre that's developed. And we mentioned, obviously, Sarah Pinborough. There are other authors and writers who've worked within this whole system. And Ben Aronovich, of course, worked as script editor with Andrew Cartmell for the Doctor Who series in the Sylvester McCoy era, and I think he was very keen to move the Sylvester McCoy Doctor into that realm of Arthurian mysticism as well. So it's something he's obviously had an interest in, and this is something he's emerged as a writer, obviously, himself. Cinematically, I think it's probably just waiting for the contracts to be signed, isn't it, Jenny, in terms of the actual lineup? I would have thought, in essence, somebody's probably going to look at least optioning this particular series.
I would have thought so, yes. Ooh. There's actually a series of rather lovely illustrations to go with the book on his website, www.thefolly.com. And yes, it's very visual, and it would work very well.
And if you go to the-folly.com, that also carries with it connotations of the Victorian Follies, but also, in many ways, the Batcave, of where our two sort of dynamic defenders actually sort of connected, Mr. Nightingale and Peter Grant. And again, I thought there were areas there which I thought were quite interesting in terms of the way forward. But
particularly Molly, the servant, who is very creepy.
I mean, you're not sure whether she's a vampire, what she's actually doing. Well, maybe she just likes the dog. Maybe she's up for sci-fi dough.
She didn't eat the dog, though.
She didn't eat the dog, no, that's very true. From your own perspective, Jenny, and obviously we are a few weeks away from, obviously, the release of your latest opus, which is, of course,
The Mothman.
A Mothman, exactly. Do you find, do you kind of look at what, obviously, Aronovich has actually produced and think, actually, yes, that's quite nice in terms of doing that research, and you can't take away from the importance of actually ensuring that the reader can actually have an identification with the locations you're describing?
I think it's absolutely vital. You can, it's better, I think, if you actually go there, particularly if you write in a visual manner. There's always going to be a helpful reader who will pick up something and go, oh, you can't get to Curry Bridge along there, or whatever. So you have to be very, very careful. But I don't think you can get away from doing proper research if you're going to write a really well-structured book that stands up.
And I think we agree that probably is the case with respect to Ben Aronovich's first in the Peter Grant series, Rivers of London, in the heart of the capital, A Different World Hides. I was pleased to see that two publications that we worked with fairly closely, both from Dave Bradley's point of view as editor-in-chief at SFX magazine, and indeed Richard Edwards, who's also there, their line was an engaging mix of magic and police procedural. This is a great kickoff to a very promising series, as well as the most satisfying fantasy thriller to hit bookshelves in quite some time. Witty, imaginative, and gripping. And Total Sci-Fi, I think Ariana Sardi was in charge when this came out. Magical, mysterious, and mesmerising. Rivers of London will leave you spellbound. It's intriguing to find that Sunday Times best-selling author Diana Gabaldon wrote, what would happen if Harry Potter grew up and joined the fuzz? Which is one of the reasons why I thought Harry Potter meets Inspector Morse kind of crossed over. Rob, it would be unfair to ask for a score from yourself because you ain't read it as yet, but it'll be worked through, but it kind of appeals to you in terms of the whole thing from that. Jenny, what score would you go for from your own perspective?
I'm going to give it 8 because I think the time travel thing is gratuitous. It doesn't quite fit. Otherwise, it would have been higher.
Yeah, I mean, I was sort of on a... I'd probably go 8.5, actually. I was thinking maybe 9, but yeah, I mean, it was partly because of that gratuitous time travel. It's interesting. It takes us into cyberspace, which, of course, is the next scenario of Book of the Month, which is...
William Gibson's stunning Neuromancer.
Yes, which I think polarises an awful lot of readers in terms of it set up the whole cyberpunk movement and addresses the whole lines of virtual cyberspace and various other factors as well from that point of view. So that's going to be the next one as far as the Book of the Month is actually concerned. Plus, of course, you'll be able to, if you fancy going down to Lincoln, you'll be able to meet Robert and Jenny in person together with local Lincoln author Catherine Feeney in an event of All Lincoln Inspired, and also some exciting news with respect to Lincoln Inspired. We can also say William Sitwell will be there, and some news, the first performance for a long time of The Time Machine on stage. Yeah, bless John Jarrold, who will be contributing to future Books of the Month, a former literary agent. Actually, now he is a literary agent, and he used to be a former publisher, so John Jarrold will be with us as well. So lots of SF and fantasy stuff coming in on that basis. That's it. That's a wrap then for this edition of Book of the Month, Ben Aranovich and Rivers of London, on Southside Broadcasting. Jenny Finch and Rob Nichols, as ever, a delight and a pleasure. And we'll gather again with our time machine and possibly Sci-Fido. Look at these dogs and cutesy dogs and Zoom beds. Sci-Fi London, if you want to find out about that. In April.
Jenny Finch, author, creator of The Drowners and Death of the Elver Man, and general Renaissance woman, your host for the Book of the Month.